This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Scientific journals are sometimes forced to issue retractions for papers. It's a decision no scientist or publisher wants to make, but in some cases, studies with huge inaccuracies or even fraud manage to find their way into those journals and out to the scientific and medical communities. That faulty knowledge can then become the basis for clinical trials or patient treatment. New data from the website Retraction Watch shows scientific paper retractions are on the rise in the United States. Jason DeBruin is WUNC data reporter, and he's been looking at retractions in North Carolina. Jason, welcome.
Hi, Frank.
Scientific retraction, this is significant, right? Because when we're talking about these papers that actually get published and read, and they're now into the framework, so it's important.
It's a super big deal. This has kind of been called the nuclear option. So when we talk about a retraction, we're talking about literally a paper that is completely retracted from the journal. There's a lot of steps that sort of could happen between just letting something live and having it retracted. There are corrections. They're called errata or corrigenda in the academic speak. There's also editor's notes, editor's warnings. I mean, there are a number of steps to be taken before a paper is actually fully retracted. And so that's why a retraction is often referred to as the quote-unquote nuclear option.
All right, let's take a look at the national numbers. What are the trends we're seeing?
It's a little bit tough to follow trends all the way back because, frankly, nobody was looking at this until about 2010. And there wasn't really any inertia to try to look at this because you have to think of the power play here. Journals obviously don't want the work retracted. Scientists don't want their work retracted. So everybody's sort of playing on the same side. Then these folks from Retraction Watch came along. We'll talk about them in a minute. And they started looking at it. So around about 2010, they fired up this website and they kind of joked that they thought they were going to be looking at maybe, I don't know, a couple times a month that they would publish a retraction. Well, they soon found out they were doing on average twice per day and grew quickly from then. So in that first year, they did about 400 stories on retractions just in the first year. Well, that's already up to 1,000 this past year. And that is, I mean, this is not comprehensive. They gladly admit that they don't know how many are even out there. So it's at least 1,000, potentially much more.
Well, all right. So we should then talk about the genesis of Retraction Watch, when it started, and what was the impetus?
That's right. It was started by two guys, Ivan Oransky, who is he's an MD, and he was sort of a health journalist. He never really practiced that much. He sort of decided journalism was better, so smart guy. And his friend Adam Marcus, who had written, he was a freelance journalist. He had written for Science, The Economist, some other places. And they basically looked at this and they realized, hey, nobody is tracking this stuff. Maybe we should start. And so about 2010, they did. And they just launched RetractionWatch.com and started publishing all these retractions that were happening.
So here you spoke with Ivan Olansky, who's the founder of Retraction Watch, and let's hear him talk about what's behind some of these retractions when he does find them.
It means that you can't rely on the paper that you're looking at anymore for one reason or another. About two-thirds of those are due to scientific misconduct, so making up the data or making the data look better than they are, or plagiarizing, that's also considered misconduct. And about 20% of them are due to honest error.
That's Ivan Oransky, the founder of the website Retraction Watch. I'm speaking with WUNC data reporter Jason DeBruin. So I guess that's the other question is, you know, how much does it matter? I mean, to a certain extent, to the scientific community, if it's wrong, it's wrong. That's rough news. It's got to be retracted. But how much outright fraud is going on? Can we tell yet?
As he said, about two-thirds, maybe even more of the times the paper is retracted, it is due to outright fraud. And this is something that the universities sort of glaze over a little bit. They'll say, oh, you know, errors happen. Humans are human. Everyone makes mistakes. And yes, that does happen. Certainly mistakes do make their way into papers and then into journals that are just honest human errors, math errors, or what have you. But what is less freely admitted amongst, you know, in academic circles is that there's, you know, more of these cases are due to legitimate fraud, scientific actual misconduct than just human errors.
And when you say legitimate fraud, of course, what you mean here is outright fraud. In other words, fraud with unfettered fraud.
That's right. Yeah. A scientist who, for one reason or another, be that prestige, be that to try to get more research funding, has made up data, plagiarized data, you know, falsified data. It doesn't need to be completely made up whole cloth. It could just be, you know, I did a study on this drug that I think is going to, you know, cure whatever, emphysema. Okay, well, it cures it in 10 people, but that's not really enough. I want to make it more impressive. So I'll just say that it, you know, did pretty well in like 12 people. Mm. And so that'll make it look a little bit better. And then I'll be, you know, have more prestige and I'll be more likely to get research funding down the line. So there's, you know, I suppose there's a continuum of fraud from, you know, just making everything up whole cloth. But at the end of the day, if, you know, if the data show that it was 10 people and you wrote down 12, that's a lie. That's fraud.
Then Ivan Oransky talks about the pressure on these on labs and universities to do this kind of thing.
Pressures are greater on scientists than they've ever been. The rate of funding from the NIH, for example, is, you know, below 10%. So that means 90% of grant applications are being denied. So you can imagine if you're a researcher who needs grants in order to survive, in other words, in order to keep a lab open, in order to get tenure and promotion, you're going to do what you have to do to get published. And for most people, that just means working harder, working smarter, all of that. Some small percentage, it means committing misconduct.
Ivan Oransky, a journalist and doctor who founded Retraction Watch. I'm speaking with WUNC data reporter Jason DeBruin. So are we talk about an increase in the number of retractions. Is that because somebody like Retraction Watch is paying attention, or are there actually more? And are we better at finding these things? And ultimately, the question is, how reliable have these reports been before we were paying this much attention?
Yeah, I think that's the most important question that you just asked. And there's reason to believe that there's actually less scientific fraud that's happening currently than there was before, even though there are far more retractions that are happening. That's because policing is getting better. You can sort of think, just for example, in plagiarizing, there's now very sophisticated plagiarism software, so that if I submit a paper, you know, the editor, instead of having to go look through the entirety of scientific research prior to whenever I submitted this, they can just run it through a document reader and see if it's been plagiarized or not. You know, we're starting to see similar advances in image recognition, for example. So it's harder to Photoshop images, if you will. And then simply, a lot of the stuff is online, so there are more eyes that are seeing it. They're just sort of the common knowledge is going to catch this a little bit better. So there's definitely reason to believe that there is less scientific fraud that's happening, even though retractions are on the rise, and frankly on the rise quite steeply here in the past few years.
All right. Research is important. Education, higher education in the state of North Carolina. What are we seeing in this state?
So that's a great question. From 82 to 2002, so in that 20 years, there were only 5 retractions combined from Duke, UNC, NC State, and Wake Forest. So the, you know, what we considered to be our biggest research institutions. So in 20 years, 5 retractions. From 2002 to now, 15 years, there were 93. So we've gone from 5 over 2 decades to 93 in just the past 15 years. So again, a sharp increase here in just, you know, a couple decades' time.
And some pretty important cases here. Let's start with Anil Potti.
That's right. And both of these cases we're going to talk about are actually from Duke University. The first one you mentioned is Anil Potti. He, a few years ago, about half a decade ago, he came out with some research, cancer research, that was absolutely breakthrough. It basically showed that you could target cancer treatments to individuals. And as you probably know, one of the tough things about cancer is that everyone's cancer is very different. So a treatment that works on me might not work for you. And so his research showed that through his marker, they could find exactly what would work for you and what exactly would work for me. So this was hailed as a great breakthrough. Okay. Turned out it was completely made up, totally falsified. The data was incorrect. It was, as we said from what we said earlier, this was not exaggerated. I mean, this was just completely made up. And the story has sort of a sad ending because it was so breakthrough that Duke then launched into a clinical trial where they tested this therapy on late-stage cancer patients. 8 people were enrolled in a trial, and unfortunately, 6 of them died. Now, it's fair, you know, these patients had cancer, but it, you know, they could have had a last-ditch effort at another university or another hospital that was based on good science instead of bad science. So this is one of those stories where it really hits home that, hey, this stuff matters to real people, because this isn't just science in a lab somewhere where I don't care about it. I mean, this was then built on.
It made its way to clinical trials.
It made its way to clinical trials. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And people died, unfortunately.
And another case, Erin Potts-Kant, former Duke researcher.
Yes, she's a former Duke researcher, but this is actually sort of still ongoing. Hers isn't as serious in as much as it led to clinical trials. but there's reason to believe that she got in the neighborhood of $200 million worth of research funding over a period of time that was essentially based on fraudulent research. She is a biologist, did most of her work in pulmonary biology. She's ultimately now had 15 papers that have been retracted. It's almost sort of a bit of a funny story, because the way that she was found out is that she had started to embezzle money from Duke University. That was found out, and then, of course, she was sort of slapped on the wrist for that, or she was punished for that. Then Duke started to look a little bit more closely at her research, started turning over more stones, and found that a lot of this was fraudulent.
Now, Duke is not alone. We mentioned two cases here. What has Duke University said about this, and what are the other research facilities in our state say?
They've been open about it. They have said that they should have had checks in place earlier, that this is stuff that they should have caught. You know, in some of these cases, it's not like you can't blame them too much, I suppose, because, you know, they want what's best for patients, right? And if something, or ideally, I should say, they want what's best for patients. And if a researcher comes out and says, hey, I've got this breakthrough research, then it could possibly help people down the line. So, but yeah, they've been honest, and they said that they should check this stuff earlier and are putting in more controls and, you know, making their checks and balances more rigorous, I should say.
Jason DeBruin, WNC Data Reporter. Jason, as always, thank you very much.
Thanks. Thank you.
You can check out his work at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we're going to preview a documentary about one man's fight for equal education in Northampton County. We'll talk about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned.